I would like to thank Town Hall Seattle for inviting me to give this presentation, and I appreciate your interest in coming tonight. This evening, we are going to address three major questions. First, can technology solve major environmental and social problems? What are the limitations of technology? Second, why do most people believe in technological progress and uncritically accept any technology? Third, are there simple and effective low-tech solutions, and what can we do? So let me turn then to the first question. Can technology solve major environmental and social problems? What are the limitations of technology? Let me start out by pointing out two extremely profound limitations of any technology. First, negative consequences are inherently unavoidable. And second, these negative consequences are unpredictable by our scientific methods. So let me explain further. Negative environmental consequences of technologies are inherently unavoidable because technology, when you apply it in the environment, to manipulate the environment in nature, they violate a number of ecological principles that have been paraphrased as law of ecology by Barry Commoner. You might know him, an activist environmental professor, as follows, these laws of ecology. Everything is connected to everything else. This law is violated by technology because if you use technology to manipulate nature or the environment in one area, because everything is connected to everything else, we will have unintended consequences somewhere else in the system. The second law of ecology is called nature knows best. And this means that over millions and billions of years of evolution, a sort of a natural research and development in nature has occurred where a natural balance has formed. And when we come in with our technology to manipulate nature, we disturb this balance automatically and will have unintended consequences. And the third law of ecology, according to Barry Commoner, is there is no such thing as a free lunch, meaning that everything has a cost. If we use technology to manipulate the environment for our benefits, we will have to pay sooner or later. And our environmental crisis we have today is really are the costs that have accrued, and these are delayed costs, and they will sooner or later arrive. Now the question is, why are scientists not smart enough to anticipate these inevitable problems? The problem is the scientific method we have been using for several hundred years is not good enough for that. The scientific method is based on mechanistic reductionism, meaning we try to understand the whole of nature only by looking at isolated cause and effect relationships. Like when we do laboratory experiments, we only vary one parameter at a time. So we look only at one cause and effect relationship while ignoring all the other ones. And so the scientific method can never elucidate all the relationships that exist in nature. So we have this very strange situation that science has both power and weakness at the same time. It has the power to study isolated cause and effect relationships, and we gain a lot of knowledge that we can exploit with technology to manipulate nature for our perceived benefit. But at the same time, because we don't know the rest of the cause and effect relationship, all the unintended consequences, we create ignorance. Science creates ignorance, not only knowledge. It creates knowledge to exploit nature, but it creates ignorance at the same time what the unintended consequences might be of our manipulation. Now let me give you two examples of this. One is nuclear energy. Science has been extremely powerful 100 years ago to elucidate the chain reactions, the atomic chain reactions, and so forth, nuclear physics. And we have exploited that knowledge to build nuclear weapons and nuclear reactors. But science is not powerful enough to determine all the unintended consequences of these technologies of nuclear explosions, the radioactive fallout, etc., or Fukushima disasters, etc. Another one, more current example, is genetic engineering technologies. Molecular biology, the last 20 years, has been extremely powerful and was able to elucidate what the mechanisms are at a molecular level, and now we are applying this technology to have genetic modified organisms that we deploy on a large scale, like GMO crops all over the country, soybean, corn, etc. But science is intrinsically unable to determine the unintended side effects of this technology. So we have this very strange, or actually bad, situation, meaning that negative consequences of technologies are both inevitable and unpredictable. So this is a very major limitation of any technology. Now, we have created all these problems with technology, and what do? We apply more technologies to solve them, and this is a technofix. That's why the book is named called Technofix. What is a technofix? A technofix is an attempt to solve a problem with technology. A technofix addresses only the symptoms instead of the root cause. It is called a fix because it does not result in a real long-term lasting solution. Technofixes are often used in an attempt to solve a problem caused by previous technologies, and we call that counter-technologies because they counter the effect of previous technologies, or to solve social problems, and we call that a social fix. Our society favors techno-fixes because it allows us to ignore large, intractable problems, problems that are either too difficult to solve or whose solutions are too controversial. Let me give you two examples. An example of an attempt to use technology to address a very difficult to solve problem are climate change mitigation technologies. Climate change, of course, is caused by technologies, basically fossil fuel combustion technologies, being it car engines or power plants, etc. And so we are trying to design counter technologies that remove the CO2 from the atmosphere, and these are basically all techno fixes. Let me give you a list of ideas that have been thought about, that have been proposed in the scientific community what to do about rising CO2 concentrations, basically these list of techno fixes. One is called geological carbon sequestration. Basically, people take the flue gases from a power plant and pump the CO2 deep into the ground. The problem is nobody knows how long it will stay in the ground, what the leakage rate will be, and if it leaks, or when it leaks, let's call it that way, what the health and environmental effects are. This shows that most technofixes, like all technologies, have unintended consequences, and that's why technofixes are not good. Another idea has been proposed, but resisted by environmentalists, is ocean disposal of CO2. Basically have a deep pipe going deep into the ocean, pumping CO2 in the deep ocean, but then that will result in the acidification of the deep ocean with unintended consequences on the deep sea biota. Then other people came up maybe 10 or 15 years ago about sprinkling fertilizer over millions of square miles of ocean. The fertilizer would increase phytoplankton growth, algae basically would start growing and sucking out the CO2 from the atmosphere. The problem there, of course, is we have no idea what this large-scale eutrophication, these large algae blooms, would do out there. Now, there are even some more bizarre ideas. Some people I read about, they wanted to put a gigantic space mirror the size of California in outer orbit to deflect the sun. So I have no idea how they would get that in an outer orbit the size of California, okay? And somebody has even, maybe it was Ed Teller, I think, the father of the hydrogen bomb. He came up with another funny idea. I think he wanted to simulate volcanic eruptions or something to have this dust flying around, volcanic ashes and dust in the air to absorb the light. So we can see here these technofixes have all unintended consequences and never address the root cause of the problem. Another example of an attempt to use technology to address a controversial social problem is the social problem is overpopulation. So we are trying to use technology in an attempt to address overpopulation, so the problems of overpopulation, which are world hunger. And this is called a social fix. Now we know already that increasing world population has produced an increasing demand for food, fresh water, oil, and all sorts of limited resources which are rapidly approaching depletion. We are not seriously addressing overpopulation because it is controversial to segments of society that seek advantage from it, like the business interests and religious groups, for instance. Instead, we witness a parade of technofixes such as the Green Revolution and genetic engineering to address problems of overpopulation like world hunger. But these technofixes have not and will not solve the problem of world hunger. Let's look just at the facts. 40 years ago, there were 900 million hungry people worldwide. Despite the Green Revolution and despite the promise of genetic engineering, today there are still around 900 million worldwide. So clearly, these technofixes have not worked and will not work. Why do we attempt to use technology to solve social problems? Because it is easier to apply technological solutions than to change people. It is easier to employ a few engineers to come up with solutions than to convince people to change their behavior in general. Another common type, or a very common type of technofix, is efficiency improvement. We hear it all the time on the media, radio, that efficiency will solve our problems. Efficiency improvements are used in an attempt to reduce the use of limited resources, like more fuel-efficient cars use less fuel per mile driven, or to reduce pollution, like less carbon emissions for a car, for instance. However, there are two problems with all efficiency improvements. First, efficiency improvements often stimulate consumption of the limited resources that were supposed to be conserved. This has been known for 150 years. It's called Jevons paradox, according to Jeff Stanley Jevons in Britain, and also called rebound effect. Rebound meaning consumption rebounds after the efficiency improvement has been implemented. For example, you can do your own thought experiment. Let's assume you buy a more fuel-efficient car, car that gets 40 miles per gallon instead of 20 miles per gallon. So you would think you would save 50% of fuel, half, you would cut fuel use in half. However, that is really not going to happen, most likely, because now your cost per mile driven is only half as much, so you start driving more because it is cheaper to drive. So basically, the energy efficiency improvement has stimulated more driving on your part and more fuel consumption than initially thought. So there's rebounding consumption. And this is exactly what many, many research studies have shown for years. Efficiency improvements, because they are generally associated with cost savings, stimulate consumption of the limited resources that were supposed to be conserved in the first place. So that's one limitation of efficiency improvements. The other one is total resource use, like fuel, is only reduced if efficiency improvements occur at a rate that is faster than the rate of growth in demand for these resources. So let me explain. Coming back to the example of car fuel efficiency, there will be only a reduction in fuel use if there is no increase in the number of miles people drive worldwide. More energy efficient cars won't help the environment very much if there's a substantial increase in car driving. And this is clearly confirmed by the data. For example, the automobile fleet efficiency, fuel efficiency of industrialized countries increased by 20% from 1974 and 1998, probably in response to the oil crisis in the 70s. So overall, cars became 20% more fuel efficient. So one would think that overall fuel consumption worldwide would have decreased accordingly. However, this has not been the case. Fuel consumption during that time period increased by 40%. Why? Because total passenger miles increased by 75% during this period. We had more people, population growth, more drivers, more cars, and longer distances driven. So as long as you have more driving going on, you can have the most fuel-efficient car, the total fuel use will still go up. So to summarize then, why techno fixes don't work? Well, they don't work because, first, as all technologies, they have unanticipated side effects. Second, they don't address the root causes and therefore don't offer long-term lasting solutions. And third, they cover up symptoms, and this makes the problems to continue to grow unchecked in scale and complexity. Basically, a bad situation gets worse over time. Now, one belief in our society is that technology will increase happiness. Otherwise, we wouldn't buy all these techno gadgets, iPads, cell phones, computers, TVs, cars, airplanes, etc. There's some belief that it will increase happiness, but when you look at the psychological and sociological literature, it does not. There is no correlation between technology, economic affluence, and happiness. Basically, our economic system is based on the utilitarian assumption that economic growth and material affluence increases happiness. This is our whole economic system, the last 200 years, is based on that assumption. Unfortunately, that assumption is wrong. And technological innovation, technologies in general, technologies are the main driver of economic growth, according to neoclassical growth theory, the main driver behind material affluence. It's obvious. We buy washing machines, we buy cars, it's material affluence. Technologies are the main drivers behind increasing material affluence. So when people look at the data and see whether material affluence has increased happiness, there is no correlation. For instance, in the United States, per capita GDP, basically material affluence, increased 2.5-fold between 1946 and 1991 during this 45-year period. Increased 2.5-fold, but happiness, which was measured by sociologists every year, has virtually remained constant. So material affluence, no correlation to happiness. Even more extreme in Japan, there was a six-fold increase in material affluence between 1958 and 1991, and there was no change in happiness. At the same time, science and technology, particularly advanced technologies, also destroy traditional sources of happiness. Traditional sources of happiness were or are, according to the psychological and sociological literature, social interactions with family, friends, and community, a very large source of happiness, satisfying and meaningful work, and closeness to nature. Life with technologies has often drastically diminished these sources of happiness. For instance, community bonds have been destroyed by periodically uprooting people to increase industrial output. Basically, people are shoved around wherever they have to go to work in factories to meet the demands of technology, basically. I think Americans move on average every 5 years to keep their job. One technology particularly destructive to community cohesion is television. The average American, and probably European the same, watches 4 to 5 hours television per day. Television is a very individualistic technology, independent of media content. You basically sit in front of the screen, and the same could also apply to computer screens for that matter, but I'm focusing on television. You sit basically in front of the screen and interact as an individual with the screen. You are not talking anymore to your wife, to your kids, to your friends, to your community members. You are just focused on the screen for 4 to 5 hours a day. Can you imagine what significant negative effect this has on social interaction and sources of happiness related to that? Also, many industrial production technologies create conditions of repetitive, boring, alienating, and meaningless work. Think assembly line. Also, finally, technology is also responsible for our increasing separation and alienation from nature. We live in artificial environments surrounded by virtual reality. So in conclusion then, the major limitations of technologies are then unintended consequences cannot be avoided and predicted. Most attempts to solve social problems or problems caused by technology with more technology, i.e. technofixes, don't work, and technology has failed to increase happiness. So why is it then that despite of all of these rather significant failures of technology, we are still fascinated with technology and accept anything new so uncritically? Well, one reason for our extreme technological optimism and belief in progress is historical. We need to recognize that the whole concept of progress is a rather recent historical phenomenon. Hunter-gatherer societies and agricultural societies did not have a concept of progress, most likely because they have a cyclical concept of time. The seasons repeated themselves year after year. Time was seen as cyclical, and if you see time as cyclical, nothing changed linear with time to get better or worse with time. It always repeats year after year. The Greeks and Romans also had no concept of progress. It is only most likely with the rise of historical religions, those religions dependent on historical narrative like Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, that there was a change from a cyclical concept of time to a linear concept of time. And seeing time as linear allows the idea of progress to develop, because this is the idea of positive change with time. And of course, this whole idea of progress really took off with the Enlightenment, where it was believed that human reason was to bring about social and moral progress. Unfortunately, social and moral progress proved to be more elusive than material progress. And so the concept of human progress was quietly redefined and limited to material progress. And of course, material progress is supposed to be brought about by science and technology, and it is measured as economic growth. So that's basically the history. You can see this whole idea of progress started rather recently and has been sort of distorted into a material kind of progress, even though it was social and moral progress before. Now, why is belief in progress and technological optimism strong today, particularly in the United States? By the way, the United States, according to statistics surveys, is probably the most techno-optimistic nation on Earth, okay? Well, why are we so optimistic about technology? Well, there are a number of obvious reasons. Technology, number one, technology has delivered the goods. It really delivers. It really has provided a lot of benefits. The problem, of course, is we don't know when the chickens come home to roost. As I said, all technologies have unintended consequences, and sooner or later we have to pay the cost. But as long as the costs haven't arrived, we are very optimistic about everything. We think everything goes to glory, great, okay. Now, the other one reason why we are so optimistic is because of mass media advertising. You turn on any TV, radio, whatever, even printed media. We are always promised that new technology will make us happy, will solve our problems, even though we know they don't really make us happy. But Of course, there's a lot of vested interest here by the corporations who sell these technologies to increase their profits, etc. So there's a lot of vested interest to keep techno-optimism alive. We also found in our research that ignorance actually is a very is a basis of most technological optimism. We coined a law of techno-optimism. We call it optimism is inversely proportional to knowledge, meaning that the less knowledge you have about a technology, the more optimistic you are. And this is nothing really new. When I go to technical and scientific conferences and you hear new concepts presented by scientists or engineers, the people who are really not quite in this field, they are often very impressed by this talk and talk to the inventor or whatever scientist. But the people who are experts in the field are generally not that optimistic about it. They have much more guarded optimism, maybe even pessimism about it. So, as I mentioned, the United States is the most techno-optimistic nation on Earth. Possibly, I mean, this is a hypothesis, possibly because scientific illiteracy in the United States is enormous. I give you some funny NSF, National Science Foundation statistics, survey statistics. 80% of Americans do not meet minimal standards of scientific literacy. 50% of Americans do not believe in biological evolution. Well, that's sort of maybe expected, but now something funny. 28% believe in astrology, okay. Now this is getting not more funny. 25% in witches and 33% in extraterrestrial visitors, all according to the National Science Foundation. I'm not inventing this, okay. So anyway, scientific illiteracy is extreme, so techno-optimism is extreme. Why is excessive and unrealistic techno-optimism dangerous? Because it is preventing us from thinking about low-tech, real solutions to our problems. Another reason we accept technology so uncritically is the myth of value neutrality. The myth of value neutrality states, or it can be expressed as, technologies are simply neutral tools which can be used for good or evil purposes depending on who controls them. But this is not true. This is only true for the most simplest technology, like a digging stick or so, to hit somebody over the head or to plant some seeds or whatever. But for all advanced technology, the value neutrality myth is clearly this is clearly a myth. It's a false belief, because the more advanced the technology is, the more the values of the designer have been embedded in that technology. Because when a technology is designed, a new technology is designed, the designer or the corporation has to make choices what to include and what to exclude with this technology. And those values are embedded in that technology. There's no way around it. Let me give you a few examples. Nuclear energy. Nuclear energy plants are gigantic, complicated, and dangerous, yes, but they have a bias towards centralized control because they're so complex and large, and they have a bias towards environmental damage because of the radioactivity problem. Genetic engineering technologies commodify plants and animals, a clear value orientation. As I mentioned before, television promotes individualism and consumerism. Individualism independent of content, just because you're sitting in front of the TV for hours and thereby it's an individualistic experience, a clear value orientation. So why should we be concerned about the fact that technologies are value-laden? Well, the problem is, as soon as we have these technologies and then they diffuse through society and everyone uses them, the values get adopted by the society and by culture, and often completely unknowingly. Actually, this whole idea of technology transfer from industrialized nation to third world nations, technology transfer, the values get transferred from one country to the other via technology. And then the third world nations wondered why their culture is changing so fast. It's because of the embedded values in the technologies that are transferred. So it's clearly dangerous to believe that technologies are value neutral. Another reason we accept technology so passively is the myth of autonomous technology. This is a false belief that technology has an autonomy of its own and therefore is an independent, uncontrollable force. Humans can't control it. Humans cannot direct it. It's sort of like this mega technology, like a juggernaut moves forward and we just get squashed by it. It's sort of like autonomous technology. One reason technological progress may appear autonomous is that many technological systems, because of their size, complexity, and mutual independence, have a rigidity, they call it capital lock-in, and inertia that is difficult to overcome. Think about our global car culture. We have hundreds of millions of cars, we have roads everywhere, we have pipelines, we have gas stations, we have tankers, we have, you know, this is just like a mega technology that looks like it's taking over and working, you know, it's an autonomous technology. And people feel trapped in these mega systems, but when they feel trapped, they unfortunately blame technology instead of the individuals, those individuals who made very conscious decisions regarding the direction of technological change. For instance, the car culture, this is not an autonomous technology. There have been conscious decisions made maybe 100 years ago by executives, politicians, etc., to have this technology in place. So there is no such thing as autonomous technology. Why is the myth of autonomous technology so dangerous? Because it diverts attention away from the need for democratic control of technology and critical evaluation before it is deployed on a large scale. Finally, another reason we don't critically question technology is related to the technological imperative. The technological imperative can be stated: whatever can be done technically will be done and should be done. Actually, Robert Oppenheimer, the inventor of the of the atomic bomb, he actually strongly believed in the technological imperative. He thought the atomic bomb should have been built because it could have been built, basically. So examples of the technological imperatives are: if it is possible to make synthetic organic chemicals in the laboratory, let's mass produce them and use them as pesticides, herbicides, etc. Just use them on a large scale. If it is possible to dam rivers, let's do it, even though it might damage the environment. If genetic engineering is possible, we must do it and create GMO, genetic modified organisms and crops, and deploy them over millions of acres in the United States. The technological imperative serves at least three purposes, all of them dubious. It is used as an excuse to avoid democratic deliberation as well as ethical decision making with respect to the development and acceptance of innovative technologies. It makes new technologies appear inevitable by hiding the fact that technological development is directed by special interest groups and powerful social classes. As a result of this concealment, belief in the technological imperative discourages not only critical thinking, but also promotes a culture-wide passive acceptance of any new technology, no matter how destructive. So far, we have seen that modern technology is uncritically accepted. Also, it has very significant limitations and in many cases does not offer lasting solutions. What are the real solutions and what can we do? Let me start with a quotation from Albert Einstein. He said, "No problem can be solved at the same level of consciousness that created it." Basically, this means problems created as a result of a limited view of reality are unlikely to be solved without improving our view of reality, without changing our worldview, without changing our paradigm. Unfortunately, our current worldview is based on the illusion of separateness. I call it illusion because even science has shown that we are interconnected to each other, to the environment, that there is this web of life. Many problems, from military conflict to environmental pollution, are the direct result of this incorrect worldview. As long as we feel separate, we feel it is okay, even ethically okay, to control and exploit, and we will use science and technology primarily for that purpose. A solution to our problems is possible only if we change from our current worldview of separateness to one of interconnectedness. As soon as we do this, as soon as we have this paradigm shift, as soon as we change our worldview, many other things will automatically change. For instance, how we treat the environment, what kind of economy we have, and what types of technology we develop. If we consider ourselves part of nature, we will not tolerate pollution. We would leave space for other species. We would not tolerate human population growth. We would not have endless economic growth. We would transition instead to a steady state economy, basically a zero growth, no growth economy, which has more or less a constant population size and more or less a constant material affluence. We would also develop different kinds of technologies. Technologies that are good for the environment and well-being of people. Let's call those environmentally sustainable technologies and socially appropriate technologies. There are three design criteria. They are very simple, three design criteria for environmentally sustainable technology. So this is not rocket science. It is very straightforward. The three criteria are, first, all energy and materials, or all energy should come from renewable sources, and most materials should come from renewable sources. So this is a renewable condition. If we use non-renewables, like metals, for instance, we should recycle them close to 100%. And if we have waste, they should be either completely biodegradable, like in a compost pile, or they should be inert and non-toxic. As we can see, these are conceptually very easy conditions, but unfortunately they're difficult to put in practice because our current industrial system violates these three principles, these three design criteria. Most of our energy comes from non-renewable sources and materials. We have incomplete recycling, and we still generate persistent toxic chemicals that bioaccumulate in species. Now, we should also have technology that is good for people, good for people's health and psychological well-being. We call them socially appropriate technologies. Again, only three relatively simple design criteria. The technology should be local and decentralized, like local consumption for local production. Local production for local consumption. There should be human scale and easy to operate, and allow, thirdly, for humane, satisfying, and meaningful work. Again, conceptually very easy, but very difficult in practice, given that the current industrial system violates these principles or doesn't heed those design criteria. We have mostly centralized technologies, we have large-scale technologies, and we often have technologies that provide alienating work conditions. For instance, in factories, I mentioned before, assembly lines. We need to recognize that prior to the Industrial Revolution, most technologies were environmentally sustainable and socially appropriate. So there's no reason why we can't do it. It has been done before, we can do it today. And we do it today, actually, in at least one very key area, and that's local organic agriculture. This is a good example of an environmentally sustainable and socially appropriate technology, and we should expand it, and we should expand similar technologies for local production and local consumption in other areas away, not only for agriculture, but other areas. Now, what else can we do? We need to have a more democratic control of technology. Let's face it, technology is a major force in our life. We wake up from the time we wake up to the time we go back to bed, we are surrounded by technologies, from iPhones, cell phones, whatever, computers, even microwaves, TVs, you name it. Despite the major impact of these technologies on our lives, most decisions regarding the development of new technologies are made by corporations and government bureaucracies. In most cases, the public is excluded from any meaningful debate. Currently, technology is designed for the profits of the 1%, and the 99% are manipulated by the media to accept any new technology. Clearly, this is a very undemocratic situation and has to change. The development of appropriate technologies is only possible if their design is guided by the values and interests of the people who will be using them rather than corporate and government entities. Citizens will need to become involved in participatory design, it's called. Citizens should be included in the research and development planning process. Technologies could be influenced thereby at an early stage before it becomes entrenched. And this is not very difficult against conceptually. Currently, we have a two-stage decision process for technology, for technological development. The first stage is peer review by scientific experts and engineers, basically to see whether the technology even will work. The second stage is a business review for profitability, basically to see whether if the company makes it, whether this technology will be profitable. So that's fine. But we need a third stage, and the third before a technology is commercialized, and that is a review by citizens' representatives to assess whether their technology, that new proposed technology, would have any social and environmental consequences that are unacceptable. Participatory design has actually been performed with success in Scandinavian countries. So if they can do it, we can do it as well. I must have been speaking a little faster than expected, but before concluding the presentation, before making concluding remarks, we have a few minutes for questions and answers. So I'm glad to take any questions.
Have you talked to world leaders about that, and what do you do when you have debates with these scientific engineer geniuses who only think about the future of the technology?
I didn't quite understand the question, whether I had debates with techno-optimists?
With the engineers who only think about the technology.
Well, that's why we wrote the book. It's difficult to have really a debate within the scientific community, because everybody is optimistic and everybody wants to sell their idea and get funding, etc. So there's this general optimism, I guess, in the scientific community, because it requires almost this optimism to keep going. So I personally really haven't confronted. I really haven't done that that kind of discussion. I have a colleague who does, and he's sort of shunned. He's shunned by the scientific community because he always points out what doesn't work, and people really don't like him because it damages the ability to get money, funding for research. If somebody always runs out, this doesn't work, this doesn't work. So people keep sort of a low profile.
And if you could change a little bit, you think we could still change the ocean acidity, so we could maybe save the ocean, or do you think it's too late?
Well, I mean, they're different. I'm not quite sure what you're asking. I mean, there is natural ocean acidification going on just because the atmosphere has too much CO2. So this is already going on. I don't know. I'm not an atmospheric scientist to really tell you whether it's too late or not. I hope not. But I hope the environmentalists stopped the whole proposal of pumping flue gases into the deep ocean. Okay, so that has been stopped, I think, by Greenpeace some years ago. But I don't know. Maybe you have more recent information. So, okay, thank you.
Over here on this side. My question would be, you mentioned that there were some successful democratic participatory projects in the Scandinavian countries.
Mm-hmm.
And would you have in mind one or two examples of how that worked?
No, I do not remember. I remember it was mentioned, but I can tell you actually one in the United States. There was the book. It was actually called Democracy and Technology by Sklove, I think. It's in the reference section of Technofix. But one example they gave about the United States, and this was design for people with disabilities, basically architects take the design of buildings into account, and people with disabilities were involved in the architectural design phase. So it was done in the United States, but this was the only example provided.
Yes,
so
now that you mentioned that, I remember that.
Okay.
Thank you for your presentation. I just have a question as a researcher and educator of many years. Without having an educated populace, and I know very many famous thinkers have said this, but we don't have an educated populace. We do not have, people don't naturally understand critical thinking as someone who teaches critical thinking. So with the absence of 90% of the population cannot think critically, which is true, what is the possibility for your beautiful vision to ever occur here? Scandinavia has much higher rates of literacy, politics. If you look at our body politic, it's bread and circuses, it's Rome. So please tell me how is there a possibility given that background?
Well, I don't know whether I can really answer it. I just have a hope. I mean, our vision is particularly related to Technofix, that many colleges and universities will use that as a text or some supplemental reading material to teach critical thinking, particularly in science and technology, and also the philosophy of science and technology. So I don't know, this is too profound a problem for me to find a solution from, even a low-tech solution. Okay, I don't know.
Maybe there is a low-tech solution for that.
Yeah, so maybe. Yeah, okay, thank you.
You mentioned that technology was esoterically imbued with the values of its designers.
Yes.
What would you say is the example of India, who has brought the technology of pre-screening the gender of a child, and they're now predicting that there are going to be many more men than women. This is a society acting using a technology. The technology does not have the same effect in the West or in Europe. What would you say to that?
Yeah, I'm not quite fully understand your question. I can see that the technology.
Technology is imbued with values of its designers.
Well, it's okay. There are some gray areas. It's not like okay, there's these two extremes. Okay, there are very simple technologies like a digging stick. They don't have any value. You can use them for anything. A digging stick you can hit somebody over the head and kill with, or you can plant a piece or whatever with it. So that's the one extreme. The other extreme is like a nuclear bomb or whatever you can only use to explode and kill people with. But then there's something in between, like a screening technology medical technology like screening gender that can be maybe used still for good and evil purposes, half and half. So there's a spectrum. I guess what I'm trying to say, it depends on the technology. Either it can be used for almost anything, like a digging stick, or it can be used for only one thing, like a nuclear weapon, or there are technologies in between. So it's not black and white. Oh, hi. Oh, Lindsay. He worked in my lab before. So.
Michael, as a PhD and as a scientist yourself,
did you used to be a techno-optimist? And what led to a change in your viewpoint? My other question was, there can certainly be many environmental costs to new technologies, but one benefit cited in the media, mass media lately, is the Arab Spring brought about by greater communication technologies between right. people and cultures, and it's having a societal benefit,
right.
hopefully. How do you incorporate that evidence into your
report? Right. Okay, so there were two questions. So the first question, whether I was a techno-optimist. Yes, I was a techno-optimist, and in a way I'm still sort of a techno-optimist, maybe a small-scale techno-optimist. I'm a fourth-generation scientist-engineer, so when I grew up, actually, I didn't have any choice. I had to study engineering, and I remember when I was a teenager, I had a very clear motivation. The motivation was, oh, I will use technology to save the environment and help society. I remember this was my main motivation, and actually it's still my main motivation. That's why I'm giving this presentation. The problem is that in between, as Lindsay maybe asked, in between something happened when I was very naive. I got my PhD in chemical engineering, and then I started working. I switched over to environmental engineering. I decided to work as an environmental scientist. And so I got hired by a very large company, an international multinational corporation, in the environmental department. And I was very naive. I thought they would hire me to clean up the environment. But then I found out, after a while, I found out they use their scientists to do experiments to change environmental regulations to make them more lenient for that company. So I left, actually, after a while. I couldn't deal with that. And so that's actually when I started thinking about all these topics. There was a key event, which is sort of slightly entertaining. There was this meeting with all these managers in the room, and I had to present my research proposal, you know, what kinds of environmental experiments to do. And these managers wanted me to bias the experiments to get results that look good for the, you know, to make the regulations better, to look better for the company. And so I just, you know, I was sort of naive. I said, look, this is objective. I'm just proposing here objective science. I'm just doing unbiased science. This is good science. And this one manager got up and said, hey, Michael, you were not hired to do science. You can do science on the weekend, okay? And so that was really, everybody in the building came to me and said, this is really funny what this guy said. This is amazing, a manager saying this to you. But that was sort of the key, this key event. And after that, I started looking. I know I'd never had philosophy classes before. As an engineer, you don't take philosophy classes. So I read all these books on science, technology, philosophy, etc. And then my wife Joyce, by the way, she's sitting there. Maybe Joyce get her. she has a PhD in statistics and also a master's degree in anthropology. And so this anthropological perspective really helped these discussions to do that. So I was an optimist, and I'm actually still an optimist, but only a small technology, small-scale, appropriate technology optimist. Now, the other question was about the Arab Springs. Basically the use of electronic communication technologies like cell phones, internet, etc., Twitter accounts, etc. This shows, this whole idea, this communication technology shows the two sides, that every technology has both positive and negative effects. The positive effects here with the Arab Spring and the technologies is that it enhances communication, it enhances maybe even democracy, it enhances transfer of larger amounts of information among more people all over the world, etc. But there are several other negative effects about it. The one thing is if we use electronic communication technologies, we are no longer talking face-to-face to people. It's not like here tonight where you see me face-to-face. It's more like, it's going electronically via video or internet, etc. And so that's kind of sad, actually, because social interactions, direct social interactions, are important. Also, the communication with electronic media is you have to pay for it. It costs money. It's no longer free, like talking to a person. And it might also even have environmental negative consequences because of all the waste generated by cell phones, computers, etc. But then another negative thing about these electronic communication technologies are that they can be controlled. Arab Spring, I think they tried to turn off Twitter accounts. I'm not really kept track of it, but there is a possibility that governments can control the communication as soon as you use electronic media like that. So again, there's this optimistic side that technology is so great, we are all interconnected with cell phones and internet, but then there's also the dark side.
Okay, sorry. I just have a quick question for the audience. How many people here tonight are engineers? And how many are in the physical sciences? Thank you.
In the 45 years between 1946 and 1991, I think there was an increase in the number of hours of watching television, at least in this country. So why did the happiness stay steady?
Yeah, it should have gone down, right? I don't know. Maybe because there were some other things that compensated for that. I don't know. Good point. I don't know.
Yeah, I have two questions. One is, I was in the Northwest in the 70s and early 80s, and appropriate technology was talked about, but it's been like no one's used that word for decades. Just wondering about that. And then also with countries like India and China, are some of them looking at technologies so that they don't import our whole culture, all the baggage?
Yeah, I can't really answer the question because I have not looked into this. I know that I vaguely remember, I think, that Mahatma Gandhi was really against that, because that's why he had the spinning wheel. He did not want these whole Western values being imported through technology. So, okay.
And why do you think appropriate technology has not been spoken of?
Yeah, that's a good. You are exactly right. When I did the literature searches and got books, you are exactly right. There were only two or three books published on appropriate technologies in the early 70s or whatever. That and nothing since then. I do not know. Maybe. One thing is there have been other disciplines formed. Like 10 years ago, a new discipline was started, a textbook came out called Industrial Ecology. So they possibly rename it and make it look fancier and expand the scope of the field. But that's maybe one explanation. I don't know, so.
Thank you for the enemies arrayed against what you're saying are huge and powerful and controlling, and they have the money, they have the corporations that they consider persons now. So some people think that the only way out of the box that we're in, the only way for some of the things that you said tonight, is massive problems. Half of humanity dying or some other kinds of use. Do you have that kind of feeling that it's going to take some giant, really, really, really bad problems before humanity will wake up and go, maybe we should change?
Well, I'm still more of an optimist. I'm not really thinking in that direction. I just hope that people just could unplug from the, literally unplug from the system, because the corporations have only the power because we give it to them by buying their products, etc. So if we unplug, like unplug the TV, unplug this whole consumerism, unplug buying things and doing local production for local consumption, the corporations and the politicians that are getting funded by the corporations all lose their power. So it's sort of pulling the rug under them. So that's my. I hope it doesn't come to a big collapse, but it's possible. We have a whole chapter on collapse, and I agree with you that if nothing changes, we are heading towards collapse. Actually, I should mention. David Suzuki, I guess I heard this maybe on the radio, he has some funny analogy that we are all heading top speed, we're sitting all in a car top speed racing towards the wall, and the politicians are at the steering wheel, and the rest of us are all locked in the trunk. Okay, so that's sort of the situation. And so I'm paraphrasing, I don't know exactly what he said.
Yes, in response to the question about if there was all this increase in television watching, why didn't happiness get to be less? Well, I think if you added in the number of people now who are on antidepressants, I don't remember the statistics, but it's,
yes,
you know, it's quite frightening the number of adult Americans, right, for instance, right, that are on antidepressants now versus, you know, when in the 1950s,
right,
but maybe they're drinking that, I don't, you know, I really don't, yeah, know, but my husband and I went for years and years and years with no television in our household, and it used to be the annual laughing thing in our Christmas letter about how my mother would bring her little thing into the house, and then we were immediately depressed by it.
Right.
So, because we found television was trying to convince us we were so imperfect, and we thought we were perfect until television entered our lives. But anyway,
no, it's
so
true.
That's something to look at with your statistic, I think.
Well, actually, we have a whole chapter on happiness. I think it's chapter 9, and there's a whole section on depression, how depression has increased, and how other happiness indicators, how this all links together. And I agree, television, this whole idea of advertising is to tell people that that something is missing, and that that something is imperfect, and that you have to buy something to be happy. Okay.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with the research of David McCloskey, but since the 70s to present, there's been an interesting movement in bioregionalism, especially in this area, in the Cascadian bioregion, which spans from about southwestern Alaska to northern California and over to the northwestern tip of Utah. What are your thoughts on the bioregionalist movement and the concept of redefining agricultural borders to water sources and redefining the area to localize production? Do you think that could be a solution to this problem?
Oh yeah, definitely. As I mentioned, local production for local consumption, basically, yes, organic agricultural, bioregional, excuse me, agriculture where the crops are adopted to the climate and the water sources, I think that's what you're referring to, that there is no long-distance transport of food, that everything, you know, 100-mile diet, I guess that's what you're sort of referring to. I have not really followed the research of the person you mentioned, but I clearly believe that bioregionalism is the way to go, particularly with also small-scale technologies and basically the right match between the crops and the land. So you don't need much technological manipulation. You have just rainfall coming and it goes there. You don't have to do irrigation, etc. So, okay.
So the first section of your talk, you spent obviously a lot of time talking about how all technology has unintended consequences because everything is so interrelated. And then at the end, you talk about the appropriate technology and your three rules. If you follow those three rules, do you think that you are canceling out these unintended consequences, or just you're hoping to minimize or mitigate them?
Yeah, the second. You cannot,
okay.
Basically, because the whole idea is because it is much more small-scale technology, it will have smaller negative impacts. If you have these mega technologies, they will have massive negative impacts. And also, if you're a little bit intelligent about how you design the technologies, maybe they will be more integrated in natural cycles, integrated with natural processes, and therefore not have severe environmental consequences. So, okay, yeah. I guess I have some concluding remarks. Okay, sorry about that. If there are no more questions, let me summarize a few key points. Be critical of any new technology. Recognize that each technology has serious limitations and that the application of technologies has always unintended consequences that are unpredictable by the scientific method. Therefore, don't believe that technology is going to be the main solution to our environmental and social problems. Instead, look for rational, low-technology solutions. For more information and how to become active, please visit www.technofix.org. Good evening.